Digital Media Insider, Episode 11, April 20, 2007. Welcome to Digital Media Insider from O'Reilly.com. On our website, we explore the future of audio, video, and photography to help you get more creative with technology. I'm David Bettino, and I edit the audio section of the site. This week, we talk with Paolo De Nicolantonio, who runs a fantastic website called synthmania.com. Paolo and I have an interesting connection. About 12 years ago, I wrote an article for Keyboard Magazine called 20 Sounds That Must Die. The article was meant to be a joke for our 20th anniversary issue, but a lot of readers missed the satire and sent us enraged letters. Paolo took a more enthusiastic approach. He turned my list into a web page called Famous Sounds, and over the years, he kept adding audio examples. I called him at his home studio near Washington, D.C. to talk about his favorite sounds.
Actually, yes. The idea for the Famous Sounds page came from an article that you wrote for Keyboard Magazine. I love that article because it kind of described sounds on paper, but in a way that you could relate to them and you could understand how they actually sounded. So I decided to expand on it. So that's how it started, basically. And actually, now that the Famous Sounds page is the second most popular page on my site, actually, after a synthesizer page. Yeah.
Do you get lots of suggestions from other people or controversy?
I do. I get a lot of suggestions, and some of them are pretty good.
Well, let's talk about some of the four that you especially like then. You had mentioned the square wave, triangle wave, solo.
Yes. And by that, of course, you were referring to Keith Emerson's solo in Lucky Man. That, I always read it, was considered the first rock synthesizer solo. The first time I heard that, I said, how different that must have sounded to casual music listeners in the 70s, because everybody was used to hearing guitar-based bands in the 70s, right? Mm. And that was something completely different, that all of a sudden keyboardists had a different tool available to express themselves. Now with the synthesizer, a keyboardist could sound like a violin or a trumpet, you know, or even synth bass. And so I thought that was really a good example you put in there.
One of the interesting things about that sound was the synthesizer nuts looked down on it a little bit because he was, I think, using one oscillator on this enormous multi-thousand dollar system. And they thought, you know, if you've got all that firepower, why are you just using it in such a wimpy way? But I think that really misses the point.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. I mean, that sound is so powerful, so warm, and so explosive, I guess, that one oscillator is definitely enough. But, you know, he used that sound in a special way that only Keith Emerson could do, and also was a pretty long solo. So that it was really the first time that I know of that somebody would do something like that. So I think it's historically very important. Yes.
I think what I was getting at was the concept of the 20 Sounds That Must Die article was that these are wonderful sounds, but people love them so much that they couldn't resist them, and then they used them over and over, and then they got tedious. So it's not a reflection on the sounds in every case, like some of the M1 stuff that we were going to talk about later. It's just really amazing, glorious stuff, but it's just when you hear it 50 times and then 50 more times. Well, actually, that would lead into the Emulator 2 shakuhachi sound. I forget if this ended up in the article, but Jack Hotop was saying, you know, after Peter Gabriel used that, everyone else should have just left it alone because he just used it in the coolest way.
That's right. That was a great sound, actually. I still like it a lot. And, for instance, Michael Cretu's Enigma, Michael Cretu used it for Satanist for the hit. And that song was also very daring, too, because besides the famous or infamous shakuhachi, it also had samples of Gregorian chants in it. It was daring at the time, but it worked, and it was a huge success. So
yeah, I wonder, is that one of the famous sounds that later made the list, people using Gregorian chants?
Probably.
Forest Pygmies or whatever the other one was. Deep Forest was one of the Pygmies.
Deep Forest, yes.
So where does that take us with samplers? What were some of the other breakthroughs for you?
The Roland D50, which is still, to this day, my favorite synthesizer. And I think it was just a breakthrough because it came out in 1987, and introduced the concept of linear arithmetic synthesis, or LA for short.
Right.
Which basically is a very clever idea of putting together a patch by using the transient attack portion of a sound that is sampled in PCM and mix it up with regular analog synthesis. And because at the time, ROM memory was just so expensive, they only had space for so much ROM in a synthesizer. One of the most famous sounds on that keyboard was the digital native dance, the one you mentioned in your 20 Sounds of Must Die. And that was such an incredible sound too. And it was used a lot over the early 90s, I guess. And incidentally, a friend of mine gave me a CD by Aldi Mella yesterday, or a couple of days ago.
Mm-hmm.
He's a great jazz guitarist. And I was listening to it, and all of a sudden I hear the digital native dance patch on one of his songs. And he's a jazz guitarist. So.
Right. Well, how does that make you feel when you recognize an unmodified preset?
It's one of my hobbies.
Yeah.
Of course, coming from, I guess, the old school, I prefer analog synthesizer to digital, but I really love them all. I'm a synth maniac. And I do program my own sounds very often. And I like analog synthesizers because, of course, they have a lot of knobs and levers and sliders you can tweak.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, you know that now, for the past 4 or 5 years or more, more than that, because the Nord Lead came out in 95, so it's been 10 years, there's been a trend of going back towards that direction with virtual analog synthesizers. And
I'm still not entirely clear. You know, I just ask myself the same question I ask you. What do I feel when I hear an unmodified preset in a song?
Yeah. I don't think there is anything wrong with it. I know that, especially on the internet, I frequently get on forums of synthesizers and keyboards, and typically you always have two schools of thought. People who absolutely hate using presets, they're called the tweakers, right? Mm. And people who use presets, they don't care about being original. But I just think that a lot of people just go overboard with this hate towards presets because, first of all, they were designed by people who do it for a living, so I'm sure they put their best intentions in it. And second of all, many synthesizers come with absolutely great sounding patches to start with. You know, you could do a little bit of minor tweaking, but in the end, it's the sound that matters, not really what sound you use. So,
sure. I guess the idea was that for people who are real train spotters like us, it snaps you out from the moment and you start thinking about the production of the song rather than the song itself.
That is true. That is true. Unfortunately, it's something unavoidable being a musician. Yes. But it's fun to spot the synthesizers in songs.
Yeah. So the other criticism I've heard is that if you use a sound in the most obvious way, it makes you sound like everyone else. But again, like the Peter Gabriel example, if you, instead of playing it like a shakuhachi, you kind of roll your fingers across the black keys, and no shakuhachi in the world would sound like that.
Right.
And the M1 Lore sound?
The M1 Lore sound was the basis for the Universe patch, of course. And the Korg M1, I remember very well when it came out. Why? Because I was torn between buying that or a Roland D50.
Mm.
At the time, they were the main competitors. I ended up buying a D50 for different reasons, but the M1 was a phenomenon. The factory ROM was absolutely amazing, and it was so much better than what else was available at the time, in my opinion. And I think that the patch 00 Universe, which was the first preset when you turn on the machine, was responsible for selling so many units of the M1.
Mm.
Because it just sounded so beautiful. Also, the effects were spectacular on the M1. The drum sounds were good. It was expandable with lots of cards. It was a hit. And by the way, I wanted to tell you about that. You interviewed BJ Lederman on a previous episode of your podcast.
Right.
And I noticed that Universe patch, the lower patch, is featured on Public Radio's Marketplace on that jingle. I don't know if you noticed it or not.
Oh, yeah. I think that was how the article started out.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
But, you know, the funny thing was, after I wrote that article, I had the chance to interview him about a year later. And I started by apologizing for picking on him in my previous article. But he's just totally, you know, whatever works. I don't stress out about this stuff. I buy mid-range stuff and then I worry about the notes. I don't worry about the sounds.
Sure. That's a good attitude to have, you know. Also, so many other sounds on the M1 was just great. Of course, you know that the piano was a standard piano that was always used in house music all through the 90s.
Right.
And also so was the organ two patch, the percussion organ.
Mm-hmm.
That was featuring a lot of songs, yes.
Actually, it's interesting, that whole idea of the sound number zero. I wonder how much discussion goes into picking which sound is going to have that position when you first turn it on. Because I had a very similar experience with the next Korg instrument, the T3.
Sure.
The patch, I think it was B00. It was some kind of sweeping waterphone sound. Just
yes.
Really captivated me. And I used to go into the music store and just play that over and over, and then until finally I, you know, got up enough courage to buy the thing. But just this year at NAMM, I talked to Jack Hotop from Korg, and I told him, you know, it was that water phone patch that caused me to buy your keyboard all these years ago. And he said, you know, there's a funny story behind that, because it was a cool sound, but I was really the only champion for it, and I had to go through a lot of convincing people to get that to go in there.
Yeah, I love the T3 too when it came out, actually.
What do you think of Korg bringing all that back as a software synthesizer now?
You know, I think it's great. Absolutely. Actually, I haven't had a chance to try it yet, but I'll definitely try to pick it up, because I'm sure they did a great job, just like the Roland V-Synth is trying to do with the D50 card. It's definitely all going that direction. I don't have a problem with soft synths. I like them too. I like them all.
Yeah, the concept of vintage digital instruments is kind of funny, because most other things, you try to forget the old digital stuff, but there's right. Something weird about the original ones. I think Eric Persing talked about that in the article. Mm-hmm. That it was whenever things like the TR-808 set out to sound like real drums but failed miserably, but somehow in failing it became this wonderful effect.
Yep. And the 303 as a bass too.
Yeah. Oh yeah, talk about that one that was on your list.
Sure. Oh, the 303. What can we say about the TB-303 that has not been said already? But this instrument by itself has created a new music genre. Acid or acid house or acid techno, and there is definitely an aura of mysticism around this silver box. In fact, it still commands a high price on eBay or on the used market. Even today, when you can obtain a sound that's 90% faithful to the original with the synthesizer or sampler or anything. I love acid house, of course, because I'm 37. I was there when 1990, when the early techno scene came up, so I just very emotionally attached. I will never sell mine, but and what else can I say? I guess Fatboy Slim said it best: everybody needs a 303.
Didn't you have a movie on your site of one of your kids playing a 303?
Yes, that was my daughter Grace playing a 303, and my son Christian plays the 909, and my other son Vincent plays the 808.
And they got it right away, right? They just took to it?
Oh, it took them 5 minutes to understand what the buttons did and what the start and stop did. And it's incredible how kids can pick up music just like that.
Mm.
And they love it. They still play it.
Do you find they take to the analog stuff more than the digital stuff? Or is it more a matter of knobs?
They like the knobs, yes, absolutely. Kids love to open and close a filter on a synthesizer or... Yeah, on a sampler, they like when you put sounds on in a loop. They love that.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I guess to wrap up then, what does it take to get onto your list?
Just shoot me an email, and I'm sorry if I don't answer promptly, but I'm definitely going to take any suggestion people want to give me, and if I know the songs, I'll put it in there. I'll try to get an MP3 excerpt. And I'll be glad to put it up there. And any sound, basically, that's that you think it's particular, it sounds different than what's commonly heard on the radio, and that's what I look for.
To hear more of Paolo de Nicolantonio sounds, visit synthmania.com or check out his blog at digitalmedia.oreilly.com. We also have many more articles about synthesizers and sound design at the site. In part two of this interview, we'll listen to some of the wackier instruments in Paolo's collection. You can subscribe to the show for free in the iTunes store and get each episode as soon as we upload it. Just search iTunes for Digital Media Insider. You've been listening to Digital Media Insider, the official podcast of the O'Reilly Digital Media site. Visit us at digitalmedia.oreilly.com. That's O-R-E-I-L-L-Y. And let us know what creative technologies you'd like to explore. Incidentally, I wrote this music using software that I learned about while editing articles for the site. See the show notes for links. For O'Reilly Digital Media, I'm David Pitino.